You are listening to The Green Flame, the DGR broadcast that brings you radical analysis, practical skills, and artistic expression from the grassroots to the global. We are your hosts, Max Wilbert
and Jennifer Murnan.
So Jennifer, it's the first episode of The Green Flame, and I'm really glad to be here with you.
I'm so pleased to be here too. We've got this fantastic interview with Sabah Malik. At the end of each interview, we'll be focusing on concrete skills. We want to give you practical guidance and advice. And for this episode, we focused on community.
Yeah, we chose to focus on community for this first episode because we think it's really foundational to radical and revolutionary action. We really think you can't have a revolution without it. It's the antithesis of the individualism that we're taught within capitalism. And I wanted to share two quick quotes before we jump in. One is from a friend of mine. We were having a conversation, and he talked about how in this culture, identity is often used as a replacement for community. And he said, it's easy to have an identity. It's hard and time-consuming to build community. And, you know, within our culture, identity is this sort of thing that you can assume. You can wear it like a certain sort of product that you can pick up and put on. And, you know, when we're building our revolutionary communities to bring down this empire that we live in, we need to focus on real strong community, and that takes a lot of work.
Yes, it does.
First, an interview with Beth Robson on the Green New Deal, which is not so green as it has been made out to be.
For me, the main criticism is that it is a growth plan. It is about building infrastructure. It is about investing. There is nothing in the Green New Deal, as I've read it, that says we should be reducing consumption, that we should be reducing our energy use.
On his deathbed, FDR was asked what his greatest achievement was, and his response was saving capitalism. And he was talking, of course, about the original New Deal. So I wonder if there are any parallels, in your view, between the original New Deal, which strengthened and shored up capitalism when it was crumbling under this extreme inequality and Gilded Age and the Depression. I wonder if you see any parallels between that and today.
Oh, definitely. The plan is very much a plan to save capitalism in a way, because it is about shifting our energy infrastructure from fossil fuel over to renewables and other quote-unquote clean energy, whatever that means, they don't say, and creating jobs and addressing inequality. So to me, it is exactly that. It's about saving capitalism all over again.
So I've written a lot and spoken about the fact that so-called green energy, things like wind and solar, aren't actually green. And we can see this if we look at, for example, the research of people like Richard York, who looked around the world and found that in areas where new solar is installed and new wind is installed, that it doesn't actually lead to reduction in fossil fuel energy use. Often it's just added on top. And so I'm wondering if you can speak to this whole idea of net zero emissions.
So the Green New Deal uses the words net zero twice, and it's very unclear to me what they mean by that, because there are programs that talk about reforesting, for instance, as a way to achieve net zero. If we plant enough trees, we will suck enough carbon out of the atmosphere that it'll offset some of the carbon that we're emitting. But it's very unclear to me that we could ever offset enough through trees or through soil management, because clearly if we're still emitting gobs and gobs of CO2. So if you think about net zero in terms of, okay, what are the technologies we'd have to further reduce our CO2, then we're talking about building massive infrastructure to do that. And so it's doing things like building power plants that will suck the CO2 out when we're burning coal, and then liquefying that CO2 and storing it underground. And if you think about the infrastructure that's required for that, it's huge. I mean, we'd have to be building millions and millions of these things in order to suck enough CO2 out of the ground. By putting the words net zero in there, they're leaving themselves a little out so that they can say, well, if we can't actually achieve building enough wind and solar to replace our energy infrastructure, then as long as we have a way to suck the CO2 out of the air, then we can keep burning some fossil fuels. And so that's a little backdoor to me.
Yeah, I certainly look at it and I see the wind and the solar and the net zero, the carbon capture technology, and all of these things really seem like methods to maintain the status quo and business as usual under capitalism, under industrial civilization, maintaining essentially the same distribution of wealth and power in the world today, and just slapping a green veneer on it.
Right, totally agree with that. And I think that, you know, even if they go into this with this vision of redistributing wealth, well, that happens for a little while after you have an emergency. It happened after the original Green New Deal for a while, and then it happened after the Second World War. But inevitably, once the emergency's over and the capitalists figure out how they're going to make money, they find ways to exploit us all over again. And so it doesn't seem to me to be a lasting solution without addressing the fundamental problems of capitalism to start with. And then, like you've said, the issue with wind and solar is if we're just simply replacing the energy source for our lives as they are, that's not solving the problem. I mean, the problem is not the kind of industry. The problem is industry. The Green New Deal, to me, should be you need to figure out how to cut your energy. You need to figure out how to stop consuming and make that a big part of any plan going forward.
So throughout history, we've seen radicals supporting a variety of reforms, not because they think that they're going to solve the underlying problems, but just because they know that they're going to improve people's lives in the short term, and while also calling for revolutionary changes. And so a lot of people are very excited about this Green New Deal. A lot of people on what passes for the left in the U.S., which isn't much of anything, are excited about this Green New Deal because it represents something that appears a lot different from what we've seen in mainstream politics. And I'm wondering if you can speak to that, that sort of tension between the need for reform in the short term and the need for revolution also in the short term, and what a sort of more revolutionary approach to these issues might look like.
Yeah. And actually, you've hit on why I became so passionate about this topic, because I see all my incredibly well-meaning, lovely, earth-friendly people who are just grabbing onto the Green New Deal because it is something that is different, like you said. It feels different to them. And for some reason, they're not able to see that it's not a long-term solution. And to me, short-term solutions are needed, but if we completely restructure our lives around a new energy source, we'll be in the same position we are today. And in the same position where it's incredibly hard to change the way our lives work because of the energy that we're dependent upon. And so I've had one person say to me, oh, well, it's an interim solution. Well, no, if we shift our entire lives around a whole new energy source, that's not interim. It's like trying to change the course of a massive ship tanker. You can't do it quickly. So I think that a radical rethinking of how we live our lives is what we need to do. And we don't have any time left to waste on interim solutions. And so the more time we spend thinking about the Green New Deal, the less time we're spending thinking about how to reduce our consumption, how to reduce our fossil fuel use. So, I've been calling the Green New Deal a moral hazard for that reason, because it is distracting us from the kinds of thinkings that we need to be doing and wasting time.
And now, an interview with longtime Deep Green Resistance member Saba Malik.
Thank you for joining us for this podcast. It's really nice to have you here, Saba.
Well, it's very nice to be on. Thank you for having me. My name is Saba Malik, and I was born in England. I am of Pakistani and Indian descent. I currently live in America, in the San Francisco Bay Area, with my two kids and my husband, and I consider myself a radical revolutionary.
I know that as you were growing up in England, you had some connections to the Black Power movement there. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
I hesitate to say I had connections with the Black Power movement as such, but there was certainly, I belonged to a number of groups that were espousing the Black Power philosophy, and it came about more in my second and third year at college, because I was originally politicized through feminism. In my very first year at college, my tutor was somebody called Deborah Cameron, who is one of the foremost radical feminists. And she had just finished a book called The Lust to Kill with Elizabeth Fraser, and it was the first feminist analysis of serial murder, serial sexual murder. And it changed things for me dramatically. And so I became politicized through feminism. After that, it became easy to extend that politicization. And that's when I also started looking at matters of white supremacy and racism, and became involved with a number of, different black power groups, I suppose you would call them, ones that were only open to people of color.
Thank you. There's a lot of unusual experiences that you've had in your life. You just talked about being in university and being first kind of radicalized by feminist thought. What are other things that have come into your life that have changed you?
Oh, that's a loaded question. Well, becoming a mother definitely changed me. I was not expecting that. I know that sounds strange because I have two children, but I got married quite late. I was 35 when I married and 36 when I had my first child. I was not expecting, I never thought of myself as a mother and I never thought of myself as a wife, but I think I've done okay. And the other thing I think that really, I know that this really changed me was my time spent in Hunza Valley, which is up in the Karakoram Mountains. I was not well versed in understanding sustainable ways of living at that time. But when I look back, I realized that that's what I experienced in the 3 months that I spent in Hunza, was living with people who were indigenous to the land, who were place-based and had been living the way that they were living for hundreds and hundreds of years. And that changed me because they were so completely different to people in the modern civilized world. They were incredibly generous, very, very trusting, very, very happy. They had no crime. They had no police. They had no written laws, although they had plenty of rules. And most of the rules that they lived by were to do with making sure that their land base, the Hunza Valley, was not destroyed in any way for future generations. So, for example, there were limits on how many dwellings could be built in any village. And there was also rules around which wood, which trees one could use for making a dwelling, and for every tree that was used, you had to plant two. They had enormous amount of quite complex rules, although they weren't written down. They all understood them. They looked after one another. While I was there, it was just after the rains, the monsoon rains, and so there was an unfortunate incident with a landslide where a man, a native of the village in Hunza I was going to, Karimabad, he died after being hit by a big rock. And so the reason I mention that is because when I finally got to Karimabad, he was being mourned by the village, and he had left behind four children, and they were all quite young. And I was able, while I was there, to watch how the community decided that family would be taken care of until the children were old enough to take over the responsibilities of being able to do for their mother and to provide for her. And it was a really amazing experience. They gathered all the elders in their Jamaat Khana, which is their place of worship, women and men, the eldest of each family, and each family decided what they could give to the family in question until the children were old enough to, look after goats or actually do work themselves. And so each family decided, whether it was food, whether it was flour, whether it was eggs, whatever it was that the family needed, each family put forward what they could provide. And people, you know, families who had a little bit more, well, they gave more because it was just expected that they would give more. So it was an incredible experience to watch that. Nobody complained. Nobody said, oh, I can't afford it and I'm, you know, not doing so well myself. None of the people in Hunza are what we would call rich in terms of material wealth. But they're all completely self-sufficient. And they're very happy. And they were very, very happy.
It doesn't sound similar to anything that we do.
Well, yes. And for that reason, I was caught out in situations constantly. There was another incident where we were, myself and my cousin, were visiting a brand new little village that had just been started by some young people. And in Hunza, they're famous for their orchards of fruit, like the fruit of Hunza, apricots, peaches, apples, incredible.
Hmm.
We stopped in a small, tiny village about 16,000 feet above sea level, and we found ourselves in an apricot orchard, and we'd been traveling for a while. So we decided to stop and pick some and eat some. They looked delicious. They were delicious. And as we were doing that, we heard this shout from below us because we're in a mountainous area, and suddenly these three figures come scurrying up the side of the mountain, and it was not a small mountain, and it was not a small distance that they scurried up to see us. We were faced then with two young women and a man who explained to us that they were brothers and sisters, brother and two sisters, and they had run up the side of the mountain to welcome us. It was their apricot orchard that we were in. And they had come up because they were thanking us for eating from their orchard because it's such a blessing to have guests.
Oh, my.
And I was completely, you know, flabbergasted and thrown by this. And then they proceeded to give us big baskets and fill them up with apricots to take them back to Karimabad so that we could share them with people there. Because, again, it's a blessing to share what you have. And it was so different being in the civilized world and being caught in somebody's garden taking their apples. You know, over here, somebody would shoot you. In England, it's different, but you'd get thrown off. You know, get off my land.
Exactly.
So that was, you know, it was just small situations. They're not small, but situations like that where I realized, wow, these people think completely differently. Like totally differently. While I was staying there, because my cousin was so loved in Karimabad, because he lived exactly the same way as the people there lived, and he lived by their rules. And that wasn't always true of the outsiders that were posted to Hunza,
mm-hmm.
as you can imagine. Most
yes.
of them came with big egos and their ideas of, oh, these people are savages and, you know, they need to be civilized and they need to have this, that, and the other. Well, my cousin was not like that, and they loved him for it. So, and as a consequence of this, nobody would let me buy anything. Anything I wanted was given to me. And I got slightly distressed because I wanted to spend my money, mm-hmm. in the money that I had in Hunza, because I wanted the people of Hunza to get the benefit of that. But they... And when I tried to explain that to one of the shopkeepers, because I said, you know, I wanted to buy some things for my mother and father and my sisters, he looked so hurt. He was really hurt, and because he just didn't. He said, I couldn't possibly take any money from you. Don't you realize that you are not letting me, giving me an opportunity to be blessed, to provide you something that you are going to take to your father or mother? That's a huge honor. and you're not letting me get the benefit of that honor by wanting to pay me. So just a really different mindset. That's so that really changed things for me. Really changed things.
These experiences before you moved to the United States, is that right?
Oh, well before. This was in 1993. the experience in Hunzar really did leave me changed. I also met an old man there who I always called him Baba. It's a term of respect in Urdu. And he spoke Urdu very well, even though the native tongue of Hunza Valley is Groshevsky, which is a kind of a mix between Chinese and Urdu and Russian. It's really interesting. But he spoke Urdu, and I met him on every morning. I used to have to go to go and get water for the day. I used to walk about a mile to this stream, get the water, and then walk back. And in that walk, I had to pass this dwelling, and this man would always be sitting on top of the wall. And the first 2-3 days, he didn't say hello, he just nodded. And then I think on the third or fourth day, he beckoned to me, and I went to him, and he said, Salaam alaikum, which means, you know, peace be on you. And then he told me that when I had some free time, I should come back and we could talk. And I was, then I was informed by other people in the village, he's a very wise man, that he belonged to an order of what they called bitterns, which the only way that I can explain that is it's close to something like a shamanic order, I suppose. And he was considered extremely wise. He was 98 years old, although he really, really didn't look it. He was incredibly supple. He was incredibly fit and healthy. And it was my conversations with him which really changed things, because he started to ask, very similar to the way that Derek Jensen poses questions in his books, rather than say this and this happens, he often says, you know, what he asks questions to the reader, like, answer this question for yourself, like, what do you think about this? What does this mean? Those are the kinds of questions that Baba would ask me all the time when I would express surprise at the fact that they had no police force. They didn't need police and they didn't have crime. What he said to me was, instead of being amazed that we don't have crime and we don't have police, you should be amazed that you come from a culture where killing children and raping women is considered normal. No, he didn't say normal. He said considered the way that life is, because that is not how life is for everyone. And that is the question that you should be asking yourself, not what, how amazing is it that we don't have this, but what is wrong with your culture, the culture that you come from, that these things exist and people accept them. That was his. So that completely, you know, threw me. And he had an old edition of 1976, I will never forget it, edition of Cosmopolitan that some hardcore traveler from Europe had left behind, and he had insisted on keeping. And this man had never been out of Hunza Valley, and yet he, you know, understood these. Oh, he said, I don't need to be able to read the words in this. And he held up this Cosmopolitan. He said, all I need to do is look at the photographs and look at the pictures of people to know that all of them are insane. And he gave it to me, and he said, go ahead, look at yourself. And it was like looking at it with new eyes. Suddenly I was looking at all these, you know, photographs of women, of men, with, you know, models with their fake smiles and just, you know, celebrity gossip and things. And I looked at it and I thought, yes, this must look completely insane to him. I get it. Suddenly I'm so used to this, but I had never questioned it. So there's no question that my visit to Hunza really changed the way that suddenly I started to look at the world.
Was it terribly, terribly hard to leave that space?
I dream about Hunza, especially when I'm distressed. It's the most beautiful place that I ever visited for every reason, for the people, for the environment. I have never, ever felt like that leaving a place before. It was incredibly difficult to leave.
I mean, it's hard for me, even in this conversation, to leave what you've described and to dive back into the insanity of civilization.
I went back to England January 94, and I was in Hunza from probably end of July to beginning of October. And then I flew back to England. So it was a jarring experience. I remember landing back in England. It was raining. What a surprise. And everywhere was just noise, you know. Mm. It was noise. And I remember feeling, I've never been able to, since that trip, kick the feeling of being displaced, being a displaced person. I still remember this. I went and I was in a grocery store, standing in front of an aisle of baked beans. And I remember I started to remember the conversations I'd had with Baba. And one of the things he said when we were talking about free will, he said, your culture gives you the impression that you have lots of freedom, but actually you're all slaves. You're all enslaved. And the way that, and I said, so what do you mean that, you know, that gives you an idea that you're free? He said, well, for example, you can go into a shop and choose between 50 different types of the same thing. Now, how he knew those things, I don't know, because he's never been out of Hunza. But I will never forget that comment came back so hard to me when I was standing in that aisle. I just stood there staring at them, thinking about that comment and thinking, you know, he said, you don't have meaningful choices in your culture. You only have the choices that you are given, and they give you this sense that people are free. That's what people think, but they're not.
It makes my heart heavy just thinking about that.
It was an education, for sure.
In the interim, when you were in the UK before you came to the States, what was happening then?
So I got my diploma in social work, and I started to work for the social services, the Borough of Croydon. And I worked in many fields, physical disabilities, associated learning difficulties, mental health, and I was seconded for a year and a half to something called the Special Children's Unit, which was the worst of, you know, sexual, physical abuse. While I was there, we actually managed to bust an international child pornography ring. And it was big. It was very, very big at the time. And I'm very glad that I worked for Croydon Social Services. I met some very good people there. But it was also some of the hardest work I ever did. One of the things that was necessary for the court case, because I'm sure you know, in a legal setting, for a case to be brought against persons, particularly with child pornography, the act has to be described. Now, for the act to have to be described, one of the things that happened was that hundreds of hours worth of child pornography was confiscated. And it had to be watched and logged. And so what happened was the Croydon police force had a special team for this case. And, you know, we had our team from Croydon Social Services. So there was generally a member of the social services team and a member of that special police team that had to watch that stuff. And people took it in turns because it's very psychically very difficult, obviously. And many of those images I have never been able to forget them.
Oh.
But particularly the cries of the children or the feigned laughter, the things that they said that they were made to say. You know, after I think 3 months, most of us were sent on a sabbatical because we were all diagnosed with suffering from PTSD from watching that stuff.
Mm.
And my thought was always that we only had to watch it. The children had to experience it. Some of them were still alive. Many of them were not.
Yeah. And then the other first thing that you mentioned, the other big life-changing experience was becoming a mother. That profoundly has changed everything about existence for you. And I've got that. I've got that too. Everything changed after the birth of my children, my first child.
Yeah, nothing can remain the same.
Never. I always, as soon as that baby was born, it felt as if there was an umbilical cord always forever between us. No matter what. For the rest of my life, there would be a piece of me that was now outside of my body, where I was forever connected to. It changes everything.
Yep, that's the way.
And it changes everything about what I understood about my body too, and the power of my body, and the power of of being female. Yeah.
Well, I moved here 2 weeks before the Twin Towers were hit. I arrived in America on the 24th of August 2001. It was a jarring introduction to live here. I think that, you know, when it happened in the morning, that, you know, I had only just been married 2 weeks. I woke up kind of late. I reckon it was about 10 o'clock Pacific time. And I wandered into the kitchen, and then I wandered into the living room, and I put the television on, and of course every single channel, it already happened, was showing it over and over again. I was clip-sized enough to know immediately what was going to happen, you know, what the media were going to do, and I was thinking, please don't let it be a Muslim. But of course it was, and then the whole thing, and everything that happened after that, was none of it was surprising. It was everything that I expected. I mean, I'm grateful that I was not living in the Midwest somewhere. I'm lucky because I was in the Bay Area, you know, San Francisco Bay Area, which is, you know, much more progressive, and it's kind of a bubble, really, because there were a lot of voices saying, oh, you know, we can't, you know, we mustn't demonize people. And there were many more voices out here of dissent. I'm very grateful for it.
Yeah, definitely. I was horrified at the idea of what would happen. With the media and with the culture and with the government and with everything else. Like your Muslim community connections, and that's your upbringing, right? So that's a whole different...
I'm not religious myself. I'm not practicing, but yes, my mother and father are practicing Muslim, and my husband's family are Muslim. In that time, I don't know whether people are aware of this, I was living in San Jose. We're in the Bay Area, and there's a town city called Fremont, which has the highest number of Afghanis outside Afghanistan, which is amazing to say, but it's true. And so and that's where my husband grew up, and he had a lot of Afghani friends, and two of them went missing after that, and no one heard about them again. So whether they were taken in an FBI sweep or some kind of by the government, because that was happening. It just wasn't being talked about.
That's terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah, it was terrifying.
It still is terrifying.
It's terrifying to have a Muslim name, and especially for, you know, it seemed to be they targeted males more than they targeted females. So I did spend time worrying about my husband, for sure.
Yeah.
There were other smaller incidents, but, you know, unpleasant, like somebody pretending to shoot my mother-in-law in the car park of Albertsons, you know, pretending that he had a gun in his hand, and anybody, you know, there was a lot of women from our mosque who were wondering if they could stop, you know, if they should stop wearing their scarves along their head because they would be targeted, you know. I was just saying that obviously those were unpleasant things. They're much tamer than being whisked away and never being heard of again, but that, you know, they're unpleasant nevertheless.
Thank you for sharing, you know, what your personal experiences were around that. One of the first interviews I've heard of you was around the issue of peak oil. How did you hear about peak oil, and what was your response to it?
I heard about peak oil because I used to listen to KPFA and particularly to a program called Guns and Butter.
Guns and Butter. Wow.
Guns and Butter, that's what it was called. Really, really good. They would have different people on. And in one episode, they had a taped speech of Michael Rupert. I don't know whether you've heard of him. He's dead now.
Yeah,
killed himself.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
But he was actually promoting his book, Crossing the Rubicon, which was all about how, you know, he believed that the government were involved in 9/11, et cetera, et cetera. But that the reason that he talked about peak oil, he said the reason that this happened is because of peak oil. And then he went on to explain what that meant, and he talked about resource depletion. And I realized as I was listening to him that this, at least this part of it, was complete. It made complete sense to me. It didn't sound far-fetched. It was terrifying, but it didn't sound far-fetched. And that was in 2002, and that's when I started to do more, you know, I started to really research it and learn about it. I joined a peak oil group in San Francisco, and I went to the meetings, and I met a lot of people who were very clever and very, you know, switched into, you know, left side of politics, more radical, I suppose. But also, you know, people who were extremely educated. There was one guy, David Fridley, who used to be the chief staff scientist at Berkeley Harmon Labs. He was the energy advisor to China for 25 years. And you know, talking to him and his fellow scientists was a real eye-opener, because they had known about peak oil for many, many, many years. You know, they understood the whole bell curve. Once I understood the basic concept of net energy, or EROI, as they call it, the energy return on energy invested, that's when I realized that we were in a lot of trouble.
Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, it basically means how much do you have to put in to get out what you're getting, right? So at the peak of oil being extremely cheap, what you needed was one barrel of oil to extract something like 100 barrels of oil. And in terms of ecology, in terms of energy as it exists in the natural world, that's like a free ride, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because everything costs something, obviously. When I realized that was now, we were at that time in 2002 down to something like now it was, you know, each barrel of oil yielded about 25 barrels, and at some point is going to not be economical. So, you know, like you put in $1, you get 100 back. Now it was 1 to 25, and it was going to get lower and lower. Now it would be interesting, actually, to know the figures on that.
Yes. No, it makes complete sense. It makes complete sense. And it's scraping the bottom and extracting everything that's left, you know, with less return.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And just the idea that, you know, it's such a easy common sense idea that, you know, if you're going to use up something, anything, faster than it can be replaced, then at some point you're going to have nothing. And then the other really simple concept is you can't keep growing indefinitely in a finite space.
Yes.
I mean, that's just common sense. Of course you can't. You know, if I live the house that I live in now, there's four of us. At some point, if we have more and more people, at some point we're not going to have any room to fit everyone. And so either you have to start killing people or you need to make your house bigger. And that's civilization in the micro.
Yes.
It's exactly what it's done everywhere it's gone.
Is that peak oil part of what led you to the realization, you know, or what led you into resistance?
Yeah, that was the beginning of my journey. As I started to read more about resource depletion, I also started to read more about, you know, extinction, die-off. I started to read more about how toxified the environment was. And finally, in 2005, I was guided to go and listen to or get a book by Derek Jensen. I had gone to a meeting that was about relocalizing economy and relocalizing food systems. And I was getting really frustrated with people's utopian ideas of how the future could look because of, you know, there was no analysis of power or the psychopathy of power. And I said this, and one of the guys sitting next to me after I'd finished speaking leaned over and said, you might want to check out a guy called Derek Jensen. I believe you and he have some common perceptions. And then I got myself a video of his Endgame talk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when everything fell into place. And I was relieved that I had come across his work and him.
What has the journey been like since? And especially, I know that you have very, very strong views on the place of feminism and anti-racism in resistance movements. What do you have to say about that?
I mean, it comes back to having an honest analysis of power and understanding that when we moved from being hunter-gatherer types or more pastoral types to being more sedentary and basing our culture around agriculture, it's around the same time that, you know, patriarchy first arises. Because what agriculture did was, for the very first time, human communities had some kind of surplus in their food. Before that, the idea of like having a surplus of anything was, there was no concept of that. That's not what you did. But once you have a surplus, now you have to protect that surplus because you don't want other people getting their hands on it. So now you have to have some kind of security force. The other thing with agriculture is that you need many people, right, to produce, because you're taking land that is for everyone and you're planting it only to human use. So now you need a lot more people, and that is the beginning of women being recognized as a resource to multiply the workforce that agriculture needed. So that's about the time you see, you know, that conquering tribes or conquering communities go into another community, they kill all the men, but they keep all the women. They keep all the women because they can use their, in inverted commas, sexual and reproductive abilities.
Mm.
And that is the beginning of patriarchy. So the destruction of the environment and the ecological integrity of communities went hand in hand with the beginnings of patriarchy. It's the beginnings of people realizing that they can otherize, right?
Mm, right.
That they can make somebody the other. The women were the other at that point. But once they could, the same way as I could, as once I became politicized, I could extend that, you know, that analysis into other areas. That's when men realized that they could otherize people on the basis of being from a different community. And so you have, you know, slowly that idea of cultural ethnic differences, meaning that you are now lower on the hierarchy.
And when did race come into it as a othering?
Racism or modern white supremacy, I suppose. I mean, we can see the beginnings of that with, of course, the British Empire. And it wasn't just the British Empire. I mean, we have France and Portugal, Belgium, most of the European European societies that considered themselves advanced, and the idea that the civilized world was starting to send out people who went into Africa, into Asia, and found, you know, people there living in a very different way, and decided that these people either needed to be eliminated, and those ones that were kept should be, you know, they should be taught the error of their ways, and they should be taught how to live. Manifest destiny and all the rest of it came later.
Right, right. So feminism and anti-racism work in building resistance, it can't be done without it. Is that right?
Well, I mean, in my view, it can't be done without it. You can't really be a radical revolutionary and want to do resistance work unless you have an analysis of both white supremacy and misogyny. Those are two very big, you know, and the other one, of course, is human supremacy. That's the first one before, you know, even before misogyny and The first one is the idea that humans are superior to every other creature, and therefore this earth is for our use and to do with as we wish. And it doesn't matter if plants, trees, rocks, mountains, insects, anyone else, any non-human. So that was that's the original oppression, making the ecological community irrelevant. And I mean, we see that today in terms of economics. Anything that is causing hurt to the environment is, as you know, categorized as an externality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As quite literally irrelevant, quite literally irrelevant.
Right.
So all those, I mean, I think you have to have a sound analysis of human supremacy, of white supremacy, and misogyny.
Thank you. I think maybe it's time to bring it on home. We've been together for almost an hour, and it's been amazing. I was wondering if we could finish with a question about what skill it is that you've learned in your journey that you find the most useful in resistance, in activism.
Probably bringing people together.
Mm.
You know, I'm good at community. I'm good at community building. And in fact, I don't know if you're going to interview Derek, or if you have, or if you're going to do it again. But when Derek and I first met, I made him a promise. And I said to him, I am going to help build a community of people who feel, because that I know that that's my, you know, his famous thing of, you know, ask yourself what your gift is and then use it in the service of your land base.
Yes.
And I spent some time thinking about that, but I knew that I'm good at, you know, organizing people, bringing people together. And we were talking about that kind of recently, actually, on the phone. Remember when we first met and you said, I promised to help to,
yes,
you know, bring people together and make a community of people who feel the same and want to resist. And then this was back in 2006, I want to say, 2006. DGR came a few years later. You know, I like to think I kept my word.
You did. You did. You bring, community together brilliantly. And when that can be very, very difficult to do. People don't know how to behave respectfully towards each other. They don't know how to engage and feel safe and feel like they belong. And you're a catalyst for that.
Especially in radical political circles.
Mm.
You know, for the most part, a very toxic environment with people calling each other out and fighting. So, I mean, it's one of the reasons that I love our community. I love the DGR community. But it's not that we haven't had our problems. We certainly have, but we are strong, and we are strong in internally, and we are respectful to one another, and we do think that it's important to be courteous and loving and kind and truthful, you know, at the same time. But so we can do the work that is heartbreaking and not destroy each other at the same time, because it is heartbreaking work. There's no, I know you know that, and
yes,
that's why that so many radical groups just kind of implode. That, and of course, you know, government interference. But one of the main reasons that they destroy themselves, because it's difficult to do the work when your heart is broken.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean that it should, you know, I mean, it's really important that we do it.
Yes.
It's not an excuse. I'm just saying that I see that's one of the reasons, and it's one of the illnesses, and that's why I'm so happy to be part of a community such as DGR, where we've given thought to things like a code of conduct. And yes, we've had a lot of criticism because of it. But, you know, like I said, when I think about the community in Hunzan, I think about the fact that They didn't have written laws, but they had plenty of rules understood and abided by. It was very important.
And one of the things that I'll never forget from hearing you talk is that striking they're running up the hill to offer me more and more and more of these apricots. where we come from, my assumption would be they're running up the hill to tell me to get off their land and to stop taking from their trees. That's an invitation to belonging that makes my heart yearn.
Actually, I couldn't speak with you. I was so overwhelmed with emotions when that happened. I thought I was going to burst into tears because it wasn't just that they had come to give us more. They made that journey specifically to say thank you to us. They were thanking us for eating their fruit because it meant they would be blessed because they had guests. And that's the most that's the most honorable thing that you can do is to host a guest. I was emotional for the rest of the day. Can I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
One of the most striking conversations I had with Bubba was about defending your community. Because when Hunza Valley and there's Nagar, there's the Hunza Kut and the Nagarites. The Nagarites are Shia, they're Shia Muslims, or Shiites, as you call them in this. Much more military, very militarized, very like, go and grab things. So they have been, and the Hunza Kut are Ismailis, and they're very peaceful people. And I said to him, how is it that you haven't been overrun by the Nagarites? Because I know that there's been battles and wars over the many hundreds of years. And he said, because we don't seek the aggression, but we are a peaceful people, but that does not mean that we don't know when it's time to fight. And I said to him, so I wanted to know, because, very much in the kind of liberal lefty circles that I moved for a while, I was definitely a pacifist for a while. I said, if you engage in aggression, then you become like the aggressor. And he just laughed at me. And he said, there is a time for laughter and there is a time for grief. There is a time for peace and there is a time for war. But once war is over, you put away your things and you return to peace. He said, there's nothing complicated about that. So that's what I want to leave you with. I remember just thinking, wow, this just blew my mind. He said, essentially, if you are not going to defend those that you love and the land that you love, you're going to become enslaved. You're never going to defend it. Sometimes you have to. It's not something that we want to do as a community, but we are ready to do it.
This is an untitled poem written by Michelle Jones. We are not this culture. We are not this society. The culture has hijacked us. The society has imprisoned what we really are. We are water and land. We are the space between the trees. We are the wind and the leaves. We are sound. We are the energy between glances of animals running, chasing, hiding, playing. We are animals laying on soil, sitting in soil, walking on soil. The soil informing us of what ground is, what our bodies are. We are sun, the warmth radiated over thousands of miles, traveling across water and land. We are power. We are the rain falling, landing, streaming, rushing, penetrating. We are billions of living beings, cooperating, flooding, swapping, picking up, putting down, merging, dividing, touching, loving, hating, dying, and being born again. We are the relationships of beings, the relationships of life.
Here at The Green Flame, we not only want to bring you news, interviews, and analysis, but also provide you with skills that you can use to be more effective. Today, we're going to focus on organizing. So what is organizing? We want to try and demystify this concept. Very simply, organizing equals organized people plus organized resources, whether that's money, supplies, or anything else. Good organizations do three things well: relationship building, learning, and action. And let's start off with a quote from Vince Emanuele, who wrote, Organizing is the highest form of engagement and requires the most time, effort, and strategy. The primary goal of true community organizing is empowering the maximum number of people and providing them with the knowledge and tools necessary to win the things they want and need. The aim is to get ordinary people to join existing struggles through identifying organic leaders in workplaces and neighborhoods. To be clear, organic leaders are not people who simply show up to every meeting or rally. They are the sort of folks who are highly respected in the community. If an organic leader vouches for someone or some cause, people listen. That's the basic criteria, and people would be wise to immediately identify those individuals as they hold the most valuable social capital. So with that said, we're going to share a few specific points on organizing here. Number one, reliable people are irreplaceable. Number two, beware abusive and toxic people and set boundaries. Number three, social skills are profoundly important for organizing. Cultivate these skills. Avoid stereotyping people. Four, in organizing, details matter. Five, build coalitions and relationships with a wide variety of people and resistance-oriented communities. Sometimes you will be surprised at who is willing to lend support. Draw out linkages between struggles and focus on these shared visions. Six, humility, respect, and appreciation for others are the foundation of relationships. Seven, do what you say you will do. Don't give your word lightly. Eight, ask for help when you need it. Nine, make time to recharge. Burned out and overworked revolutionaries are no use to the movement. 10. Focus on the long-term struggle. 11. Sometimes you have to take risks. 12. Never stop learning. Plan to become an elder as you age. 13. Justice is on our side. Be heartened by the spirituality that comes from battling injustice and building beautiful cultures of resistance. 14. Be so stubborn, they will never stop you. Never, ever, ever give up. You have been listening to The Green Flame, a Deep Green Resistance podcast. You can find us online at dgrnewsservice.org. You can also find us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever else you listen to your podcast. Please rate the show and leave us a review. Thank you for listening, and until next time.
She who reconciles the ill-matched threads of her life and weaves them gratefully into a single cloth. It's she who drives the loudmouths from the hall and clears it for a different celebration where the one guest is you. Spoke to me through the trees. She said, "Daughter dear, you come from a lineage of grief. These women who are bound to you, they're gifted with sight. They can see you now as they saw you. Come to you in the night and say, keep her moving, keep her shaping, keep her safe, safe in this life. Keep her speaking, keep her feeling, keep her safe, safe in this life." words we reconcile the weaver and the wolf with barefoot love climbing. Safe.